I don't know how we, the fourth cosmologist slash gravity talk. So Macarena Lagos is visiting us from Imperial in Oxford. She's a PhD student working with Pedro Ferreira and Jean Maguija. She's going to tell us about parameterizing GR in cosmology.
Cosmological linear perturbations.
Linear perturbations.
Yes. Yeah, so that's the title, parameterizing cosmological linear perturbations. And we've done this work in collaboration with Pedro, Tessa Baker, and Johannes Noller. And the idea is that it's basically a method for constructing parameterized models that can encompass the gravitational, the cosmological description given by various gravitational theories. So I'm going to start with a very short introduction, then very briefly talk about cosmological perturbations, and then explain specifically this this parameterized method. So let me start then with the introduction. So we know that GR at small scales, at solar system scales, is very accurate. And we know that because on one side, well, GR actually fits data. But more importantly, we have done what we call model independent test. So basically, this means that we have actually compared the predictions that GR gives with the ones that a possible modified gravity theory gives in this regime. And we have done so with by using the PPN formalism, so the parameterized post-Newtonian formalism, which is a model that has many parameters and basically parameterizes possible deviations from Newtonian's potential in the weak field limit. And the idea is that then specific values for these parameters correspond to specific gravity theories. And what happens is that you can compare this parameterized model to data and constrain these parameters, and they happen to have a value very close to those of GR, to the parameters of GR. Meaning that, so with these parameterized models, we can conclude that it seems that there are no viable deviations from GR in this regime, at least. So because of that, we are kind of fairly happy with how GR works in this regime. But the question is, what happens on larger scales? And again, on one side, we could say that GR actually fits data. But for this to happen, we know that we have to include these major known components, dark matter, dark energy, some inflaton also. And GR doesn't give any explanation to the origin of these components. And because of this, we say that we're kind of theoretically unsatisfied with GR in this regime. And because of this, there's been this production of many possible modified gravity theories trying to give a more fundamental explanation to these issues. And what we have to do is then compare each one of these theories to data to see whether they're actually viable or not. And instead of doing it one by one, the idea is that we want to have a parameterized model, something equivalent to PPN, but now in this other regime. So we want to have, again, a model-independent test. And for this, the first step would be finding a parameterized model, so something like PPN, which is appropriate in this regime and can encompass relevant modified gravity theories, of course, GR as well. And once we have this parameterized model, we would like to compare it to cosmological data, constrain these parameters, and try to find our best fit cosmological model. And so this is going to be specifically in this regime. And then after that, you might want to, for example, try to look for the full theory that leads, for example, to this specific best fit cosmological model. You might want to do that at some point. Okay, so this is where we're trying to address in our work, basically finding these parameterized models. And there has been also some work done before in that regard, and I'm going to mention one specific example later. So let's continue then. But before I explain this specific parameterization that we do,
can use other boards as well.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. Well, I already erased this one, so. Okay, so before explaining this specific parameterization method, let me very briefly mention perturbation theory. So as I said, we would like to construct a model, a parameterized model that is only valid in this cosmological regime. So for that, we use perturbation theory. We know from CME data and galaxy surveys that the universe is highly homogeneous isotropic at large scales. So basically, our model will be that we have a background that is perfectly homogeneous and isotropic. We will start saying more specifically what's going to be in this model. So we're going to assume metric gravitational theories. So we're going to have a metric, a background metric that I'm going to call G bar, with this line element. And at the level of the background, you would also add some matter. So a perfect fluid. And when I say matter here, I mean the standard matter components. And on top of that, you could also have extra fields. Because remember that here we're trying to consider also modified gravity theories, which in many cases have more fields. So more extra field, I mean extra scalar fields, or sometimes they have two metrics, etc. So you would give us a background for all the matter fields and the extra fields that you could have. And then on top of that, you would have perturbations. So again, now the full metric will be this specific background metric that we assumed here, plus some small perturbations. And again, you would do the same for the matter fields and the extra fields. So this basically gives the setup that we're going to be using, and then to analyze how the universe evolves in a specific model, what you would do is that, well, take that specific model, see how this background is going to evolve, and then see how the perturbations are going to evolve. And we can do that at the level of the equations or at the level of the action. So suppose that we take a given theory. So this is the way we would normally proceed. We take a given theory, say GR, and let's work at the level of the action. So that means that we start with a full nonlinear theory. We would have something like this, plus some matter Lagrangian. And the idea is that here, in this action, you will replace your background and perturbation fields and Taylor expand around that background. And here we'll consider the case in which we only care about linear perturbations as a first approximation. Of course, you could generalize that, but we know that from linear perturbations, we can get a lot of information already. So you would expand your action up to second order if you're interested in these linear perturbations. Because this quadratic action, so quadratic in the perturbation fields, in the delta G mu nu, etc. So this action is going to be the one that gives you linear equations of motion, so linear in the fields. Okay. And this one is going to give you zeroth order equations of motion. So if we worked at the level of the action, this is the way we would proceed. So if we care about only linear perturbations, we would expand our action up to quadratic order. And from the linear and quadratic actions, we could obtain the equations of motion and determine the evolution of our background and perturbations. So what we are going to do in our parameterized model is parameterize this action. So the quadratic action that determines how the perturbations are going to evolve. And I mentioned that we could also do this at the level of the equations. So we could have instead of starting with the full nonlinear action, we could have started with the full nonlinear equations and Taylor expand the equations. And I mentioned that because now we are interested in generalizing the modified gravity theory. So we would like to take GR as our fiducial model, and from that consider generalizations. So you could do that at the level of the equations or at the level of the action. So if you do it at the level of the equations, you would start with the equation from GR, and you might consider possible modifications, extra terms that you could have here. Now, as I said, in our case, we do it at the level of the action. So in GR, this action, we're going to have specific interaction terms between the metric. And the idea is that we want to add other possible interaction terms that we could have with other possible fields that might be present in a modified gravity theory. So that's what we're doing. It might sound very simple, so it is basically what we're doing is constructing quadratic actions for perturbation fields around expanding backgrounds. And these quadratic actions will have some parameters, basically determining the possible interactions that we could have between our fields. And this is really going back to the very basics, it's just writing quadratic actions. But it hasn't been done before for a reason that, well, one reason that I'm going to mention in a moment, but it hasn't been done before except for the specific case of scalar tensor theories. So when you imagine that you have a modified gravity theory that has a tensor and an extra scalar.
When you say interactions at the quadratic level, is everything just decoupled?
So what do you mean that it's decoupled?
Your tensor modes and scalar modes, and you have a separate action for each.
So I mean interactions between you will have quadratic terms for your metric and also interaction terms between the perturbations of the metric and your extra fields, your matter fields also sometimes. So that's what I mean.
But the metric is just a transverse traceless spatial tensor.
Yeah.
That's the two mode, and that can never couple to a scalar at quadratic level.
So you don't know that here, because actually, so if we have, here we're considering a very general setting. So we actually don't know how many degrees of freedom this metric is propagating. That's the first thing.
But whatever they are, you can just categorize them into
yes.
Tensors, scalars, and so on, and they're all just decoupled.
But then,
can you tell us what kind of assumptions you're making on?
She's talking about the scalar interaction.
So you could also have extra vectors, or extra tensors, or extra scalar.
Right, then you just have a separate quadratic action for each one.
Right. So the
between higher wavelengths.
No, because if you have an isotropic homogeneous background, then it's all.
Yeah, you can. You can separate. Right. So around homogeneous isotropic backgrounds, you can always separate your general perturbations on scalar vector tensors. So we don't write down a general a separate action for those three. You just write down one, and from that one, you can get the three. But what the assumption that we're making is that we're going to write down quadratic actions for a given field content. So we're going to assume, so there is, for example, one metric and one scalar field and nothing else, or two metrics.
Okay, but at the end of the day, isn't it always just a whatever the degrees of freedom are, there's a spin 2 degrees of freedom, there's a transverse traceless tensor, if there's a scalar degrees of freedom, there's a scalar, all that other stuff is gauge stuff and can be
right.
It might depend on how you choose gauges and so on.
Yes. So
it's as not I just parameterize the physical stuff that you get at the end of the day.
So one thing is that in this action for now, so it could have a gauge symmetry or not. We don't know it. So the idea is that we're gonna write the most general action. Then on top of that you could assume that it has some given gauge symmetry. And then simplify your action.
I would say the answer to the most general action is just a scalar act, sum of scalar actions plus a sum of vectors plus a sum of tensors.
Yeah, Yeah, so, okay, so I'm going to continue, and probably that's going to clarify the specific way we're going to do it and the questions that you have. Okay, so as I said, we're going to write down these quadratic actions, and it hasn't been done before except for scalar tensor theories. And the reason, so one of the main reasons I would say that it hasn't been done before is because at some point, and I will show you later why, we would like to impose some gauge symmetries on these specific actions. So we don't want to write down like an arbitrary quadratic action. So we would like to have, I don't know, to be, for example, linearly diffeomorphic invariants in most commonly. You could also have like a U1 symmetry if you have an extra vector, etc. And how to impose those gauge symmetries into these actions can be an issue. So the idea is that in the way we do it, we do it in a very general and systematic way. And we can actually write down these actions for any field content and impose any kind of gauge symmetries. And you just have to follow the steps. Huh?
You can switch the boards, but
okay.
Let's simplify yourself.
Yeah. Okay, so let's explain specifically then this parameterized model. Okay, but before explaining our specific case, I said that there has been some work done before, as I said. So scalar tensor theories had been worked out for this specific case. And that is known as the effective field theory of dark energy. So that's the name for this parameterized models. Because the idea, so the original idea is that you're going to have modified gravity theories in which you have an exoscalar that is acting as dark energy. So you don't have a cosmological constant. So in this is valid for scalar tensor theories. And therefore, basically, they're constructing these quadratic gravity actions, which are going to be a functional of the perturbations of that scalar and this metric. So, well, here, let me cite this in case you want to look for this. Okay, and well, in this specific case, are you looking for these quadratic actions that are diffeomorphism invariant? So they take advantage of that, of the fact that they're going to be diffeomorphism invariants, and they actually fix the gauge, and they choose the unitary gauge, basically in which the perturbations of your scalar are going to be zero. And therefore, this quadratic action in that specific gauge is just going to be a functional of your metric and nothing else. So this simplifies calculations, of course, because you have one less field. And therefore, what they do is just construct this action for just the metric. I'm not going to explain the details on how they do that. But the result is going to be very simple. I'm going to mention what a specific case later. And therefore, well, this works very well. But the issue is that this specific gauge choice can kill an extra scalar field that you could have. But it's very difficult to generalize, because if you instead of having a scalar tensor theory had a vector tensor theory, then there might not be any gauge that's gonna kill completely or set to zero completely the extra degrees of freedom of your vector, or if you have two metrics. So in general, you cannot have a quadratic action that's just gonna be a function of one metric and nothing else. So this specific method works only for scalar tensor theories. And the question is then how to extend this. And that's what we try to address with our method. As I said, the idea is that we can apply the method to any field content. Yeah, yeah.
The scalar tensor theory is the scalar field gives you the extra degree of freedom that breaks the weak equivalence principle, or so if you set it to zero, but maybe not. throwing away the new physics?
No, it's just, so this is a specific gate choice in which the scalar is going to be hidden here somewhere in the metric degrees of freedom.
Right, I'm thinking in the Einstein frame. And so in the Einstein frame, I have regular general relativity coupled with the scalar field.
Yeah.
Am I not allowed to think of it that way? So thinking,
I thought the story was in perfect world. We're choosing a particular slice.
Yeah.
Is that the cosmology or the
part? She's just choosing a gauge.
Choose your time to be constant field.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Then have a
so the thing is, if you pick it as your time, they said that this scalar field is your preferred time. So then by
that's
also
that's
works for if you have only one scale, right?
That's what you said.
No, it works if there's any number of fields. You probably just pick one of them and say,
Right.
I can eliminate one that way, but I can't eliminate more than one.
That's right.
Right, you cannot kill all of them.
Right.
Yeah, so that's what I was saying, that in general you cannot fix a gauge that's going to kill all the extra fields. So that's why this will only work for those scalar tensor theories. So as everybody said, this is specific choice of a time coordinate, and the resulting action will have the same physical degrees of freedom. It's just a specific choice. So how do we extend that? So that's what we try to do. So then let's call it just alternative parameterization. So now I'm going to explain our method. And I would say the main ingredient are going to be the nether identities. Because of what I just said, that in general, it should be very easy to write down the most general quadratic action that you could have for a given set of fields. But the question is then how do you impose this action to be gate invariant under any gate symmetry that you desire to have? And for that, we're going to use the nether identities. So this.
Maybe I can go back to my question. If you're only talking about the quadratic level, why do you care about any of this gate stuff or anything at all? Why not just parameterize the actual physical degrees of freedom? Tensor.
Okay.
You never have to mess with gate stuff at all.
Yeah. That's true, but. So that's not usually the way we do it, and at some point you would like to connect this action with actually the full nonlinear theory.
Okay.
So the idea is that it looks like in the more fundamental way that you could have it. So it's very easy to actually say, for example, so these specific values for the parameters are associated to these specific full nonlinear well-known modified gravity theories, stuff like that.
Okay, but that's given any nonlinear theory, it's easy to do that. It's easy to just linearize it and then fix
yes.
the gauge and get that.
Yeah, but the idea is that it should be easy to go the other way around because you have this parameterized cosmological model, you would have to compare to data and you would have your best fit cosmological model. And then you would start trying to go back and try to find your nonlinear theory. So for that, we write it in this specific way. I
think I don't understand what Claire is asking. So are you saying that you fix the gauge and write an arbitrary action?
Yeah,
or?
I would say the most general linear action for cosmological model is
quadratic.
The sum of quadratic,
yes.
The sum of scalars plus the sum of tensors plus the sum of vectors.
Yeah.
So
I think, isn't it
quadratic
idea
model.
Is it?
That's all.
Isn't it, it's an analogy like, for example, you could write down like inflation, right? Action
yeah.
for different scalar with different potentials.
Yeah.
But you could write down one more generic way of action where you just phenomenologically cannot tune them.
Yeah, you just have arbitrary functions of time.
Exactly. So I think that's that.
But what guarantees get a diffeomorphism invariant? What guarantees diffeomorphism invariant?
So he's thinking
but
about like
invariance is all gauge anyways. So
yeah.
So you don't mind diffeomorphism invariant, so do you want to?
Well, I don't even know why we care about that at the linear level.
I don't think it's
a theory invariant by doing this.
By introducing an extra scalar. Okay. So that
question is not related to whether it's linear or not, I would say. So because you could also do the same for full nonlinear theories, like fix a gauge and have your theory without any gauge symmetry and with the same physical information. So the question is why do we want to even have a gauge symmetry in the first place? So So well, in many cases, having a gate symmetry simplifies the action. It's going to look much simpler than if we didn't have a gate symmetry. And given that in most cases, in most well-known nonlinear gravity theories, we do have a gate symmetry, the idea is that here we would have the same, we would like to have the same structure. So that's the idea. Okay. So this method is going to have three steps. So step one is going to be like a setup step in which I'm just going to give general characteristics of this quadratic action. So I'm going to say what is going to be the field content. So that means how many fields and what type of fields. I'm going to say whether I want to have any gate symmetry and which one. And I would give some ansatz for the background and assume on top of that perturbations. So before I mention the homogeneous anisotropic background, but in general, this will work in any background. So you could apply this to anything. I'm going to mention in the steps, I'm going to be mentioning the steps in the most general situation. And as I explained them, the idea is that we will work out a specific case in which we have this homogeneous anisotropic background. So let's assume this example of scalar tensor theories, which are the most simplest ones. So if we had this scalar tensor theory, then we would follow the first step, which basically means what is the field content? That would be a metric and an extra scalar that I'm going to call chi. And well, in general, we will have extra matter fields, extra the normal standard matter fields. So for now, I'm going to keep it general and just say matter. Could be a general perfect fluid. And do we want, well, the background, homogeneous anisotropic. And on top of that, we assume perturbations for each one of the fields. And do we want any gate symmetry? Well, in this example, we will, because I want to show a specific situation, which is when we have linear diffeomorphism invariance. So should I use this one again?
And just to check, you're going to be limited to four dimensions throughout, right?
Can you repeat that?
You're going to limit yourself to four dimensions throughout this, right?
Yeah.
Of course. Of course not. Okay.
Yeah.
I think the evidence is pretty strong.
I think there's no evidence for this. Before I say that they're only four. If you think you have some, I'd love to hear.
Okay.
But keep going.
Yeah. Let's continue. So we set the field content, the background, and here I said that I would impose linear diff invariance. So that means that I would like my action at the end to be invariant under this specific coordinate transformation with this epsilon mu is going to be a small parameter. So in that sense, this is going to be a linear diff invariance. And the action can only be gate invariant under this linear diff because the background is fixed. So we will only allow coordinate transformations that leave our background the same, but they can change our perturbations.
So I guess I'm just thinking, I can also fix longitudinal gauge, which is like many cosmonauts' favorite gauge, and then write whatever you want in that gauge. So is that, I mean, is that going to be fundamentally different? I mean, I guess it's just a different gauge from what you were saying before. But I mean, this works for any kind of series. You just say you fix longitudinal, the Newtonian gauge, and then write whatever you want.
Yeah. But as I was saying, in general, we would like to have the gauge invariant version.
You want it to be manifest. Like,
right. Yeah. So. Okay, so I was saying that we will impose our action to be diff invariance under this this coordinate transformation. And well, from here you can work out how all the fields are going to transform under this specific transformation. So for example, the perturbations of the scalar are going to transform as this, epsilon mu, d mu chi bar. So chi bar is the background value. which in this case will be a function of time in homogeneous isotropic background. And then, well, you could work out the same for the metric and your matter fields. And at the end, you would like your action to be invariant under this transformation of the fields. Okay, so that's a step one. That should be very straightforward. So now we go to step two. So step two is writing down the most general action. And at this point, we're not going to say anything about the H invariance. So it should be very easy. It's just basically writing down all possible quadratic interactions that we could have. So we're going to construct.
By assuming a certain form for the gauge symmetry, would you be missing things like due to modular gravity that have a different form of gauge symmetry?
So basically, yes. This parametrization would only encompass those theories that, when they are in linear diffeomorphism invariants, they have one metric and one field. Sorry, and one scalar. But the idea is that, so that's why I say that that this method is for constructing parametrized models, because you could actually apply it then to different field contents.
Well, but not just the field content, but the form of the gauge symmetry
itself. Yeah, you could also apply it to situations in which you also have different gauge symmetries. And you would get different number of free parameters, different kind of interactions, therefore, and stuff like that. And at the end, I'm going to mention some examples in which we applied it. So, but for now, I mean, for just explaining the steps, I'm explaining this specific case. But then I'm going to mention some different cases. So, step two, we're going to construct this action, which doesn't have any gauge symmetry. So, the straightforward way would be, as I say, just writing down all quadratic interactions. And in front of each one of these quadratic terms, you would put a free coefficient that is, in principle, arbitrary. I'm gonna call it free parameter. So these parameters are not constants. They're in general functions of the background. So in this specific example that we're working out, it would be functions of time. So this would be the straightforward way. However, there is a little detail, so we could actually write down an infinite number of these terms if we started adding more derivatives. So we're going to put some cutoff here, a maximum number of derivatives. And once you set the number of derivatives, then you're going to have a finite number of these terms. And this is the way we're going to, I'm gonna use for this specific scalar tensor example, but in our paper we actually do it in a different way, and at the end the result is gonna be the same. The only difference is that in this different way, these free parameters that before you put in just my hand, they were like arbitrary things, these free parameters can be expressed in terms of some underlying gravity theory. So the idea is that you're going to assume that there is some nonlinear gravity theory, and the action that we're constructing is just the quadratic version of that action. And if you assume that, then you can actually express all these free parameters in terms of functional derivatives of this nonlinear Lagrangian that you don't know. And this is very nice, and it's very useful for what I was saying before. So at some point, you would like to start going back from your cosmological model to reconstruct the nonlinear theory leading to your best cosmological model. And for doing that, this should be very useful. So basically, you're relating these free parameters with properties that your underlying theory need to have. And, well, this is the way we do it in our paper, and it was actually used for the EFT of dark energy. Not originally, but there was other group that decided to do it in that way, which I find very useful. So let me get this one here. So now let's talk about this example of the scalar tensor theory. So for the example that we were working out, scalar tensor theory, we need to have, as we know now, a maximum number of derivatives. And I'm going to mention the case of maximum two derivatives. So that means that we're actually going to write down all possible terms that lead to second derivatives in the equations of motion. And
In the equations of motion.
Yeah. So as I said, I'm going to write down all possible terms that lead to in the action that lead to second derivatives in the equations.
So it's a special and temporal.
Right. Yeah. In this example that I'm mentioning. So we want basically to construct this gravity action. And well, here's a little detail. So here I'm parametrizing the gravitational action. So in this example, I'm actually assuming that I know the form of my matter action. So we know that in this cosmological background, I will have some matter components, some standard matter components. And I'm going to assume that I know the form of those, but I don't know the form of my gravity theory. So I'm only trying to parametrize this action, the gravity action. Which in this case, no matter what your matter components are, it's going to depend on these two fields. These are going to be my gravity fields. So, but here I want to mention that the way we do it, we actually use the ADM formalism. So we're going to separate space and time. So I'm going to write my metric in this way. So hij nidt plus dxi. And aj dt plus dxj. So like all. Yeah, I'm gonna say it now. So all the degrees of freedom of my metric are gonna be in the laps, shifts, and this. Okay, so the reason why we do it is not compulsory, but we decided to do it this way. Well, for two reasons. So one, we can directly compare with the EFT of dark energy formalism because they actually fix the gauge. And for that, they use the ADM formalism.
Are you talking about the background metric here, or the delta?
Both. Yeah. So the perturbations we will be written in terms of the ADM formalism, and we actually use the ADM formalism. I mean, it's not that we just decided to rewrite our metric. So we use it because in some examples we actually impose a different number of maximum derivatives for time and space because we know that in many cases, higher time derivatives are associated to unstable modes. So to avoid parametrizing that kind of cases, we decided to impose a maximum of two time derivatives, but allow higher spatial derivatives. So as I said, it's not compulsory. You could do it.
Higher spatial derivatives would still be even, or are you going to allow for all number of derivatives?
So I need to consider a specific cutoff in this parametrization. So. We actually do it for three spatial derivatives, then
bad.
For four spatial derivatives. Sorry?
What would be bad?
What would be bad?
Three spatial derivatives.
Why that would be bad?
Because the theory would be completely imposed.
Would be what?
Imposed.
You just put that in.
No, because in what sense? Because
second time derivatives of field equal third time derivative. Three spatial derivatives of the same field on the right hand side would invariably lead to unbounded solutions.
No.
So
I don't think that's general. So there is
general.
Oh, yeah. So there is one well-known case, which is Biot-Kondesky. It's a full nonlinear theory. It's the most general theory of a scalar tensor that leads to third-order derivatives. And what happens at the linear level, so it's written in the fully covariant 4D way. But if you go to the linear level, so if you expand and you find your quadratic action, you actually find that there are only two time derivatives, but three spatial derivatives.
Yeah, and this one.
And
I'm sorry.
Yeah. Well, this is the proof that
it's one line.
Can you show it to us? I mean, kind of.
No. Yeah, sorry, go ahead.
No.
You're going to say the same thing I was going to say. Go ahead.
Just do a Fourier expansion, do a local, and then do a high frequency limit of that equation, and then you have sigma like this. Whatever.
I just want to be able to point you with confidence.
And then you're going to have this sigma will just go up.
Okay.
Arbitrarily fast. So just give me any amount of energy you want, and just make it as little as you want. But I can choose the frequency.
So you're going to get odd powers of k.
It would just blow up.
So
you're going to get imaginary frequencies, which are bigger at larger k.
But I think at the quadratic level, you never get things like this in the actual physical modes. Is that correct? Because if I always go to the transverse traceless, I break everything into transverse traceless components, you never get an odd number of derivatives on something.
Yeah.
You could get a not number of...
Yeah, I don't think
you
can actually write it down.
Yeah.
I mean, because you cannot make it not covariant, but just you cannot. How you suppress the three indices, right?
Right.
So,
right. So all you're dealing with is transverse traceless things at quadratic order. You never get.
So if you wrote in this, I mean, in general, you should be able to write it. Well, not in general, maybe in some cases. You should be able to write it in this full 4D covariant way, but basically some terms would have to be related, so in somehow the time derivatives are gonna cancel at the level of the linear action. So that's what I imagine that could happen.
So the problem is if you have something like this, like phi double dot is phi triple prime.
Yeah.
So this is what the problem that you're talking about. But then you're saying you have an equation like this. Because this has the instability that Lewis.
Right. Let me think if you could have something like that.
I mean, I would say you could use it a criterion. If you have something like that, okay, then you can be multiplying
so,
the parameter is exactly zero.
Yeah, so I don't think you could have something like that. So I don't think you could have something like that because, so in this specific case that we're working out, so this action is going to be fully different variant. I mean, sorry, linearly different variants in four dimensions. So you should be able to write it in this full 4D covariant way. And as I say, what I expect to happen, we haven't written it in this full 4D covariant way. But basically that some terms are going to be related in such a way that the time derivatives are going to cancel. That the higher time derivatives are going to cancel if you separate time and space.
But this doesn't have higher time derivatives.
You just have the space, the prime terms.
But yeah, but time derivatives also. So what I'm saying is
the
that...
The problem is with the special. I mean,
but
even
what
if
I'm
you
saying,
have two time derivatives, it's unstable because it has three special derivatives.
Yeah, but what I'm saying is that, so our specific example is going to be 4D invariant. So at the end. So I don't expect that to be possible to write if because your equations are also, should also be possible to write them in this 4D covariant way. So I think maybe this is a specific case in which it's not going to happen. We would have to actually check that.
Maybe we should let her go on and then,
yeah.
And then kill the theory that are bad.
Yeah. Okay. So yeah, what we're doing is in principle imposing two maximum time derivatives,
mm-hmm.
but higher spatial derivatives. And as I say, in principle, we should be able to write Julie exactly the same, but in the 4D covariant way, actually. So, basically we're constructing this quadratic action that in this ADM form are gonna be of this, is gonna be a function of these perturbations. So as I said, we're just going to write down all possible terms, and we're going to put a free coefficient in front. So, sorry?
No, that's high. That's like six or six.
So six in action, but when you write the equation
of
motions, doesn't
it
give you three?
No, it's k to the six, so the six derivative is on the
shaft. Right.
It's an even number.
Okay, so as I was saying here, we're going to write down all possible quadratic terms with a free coefficient in front, and basically consider all possible terms. So this is a time derivative, and then, I don't know, something like delta n delta chi, etc. Okay, so the idea is that this is very straightforward, and all these L3 parameters are going to be functions of time. And here we're just writing down all possible interaction terms. And in this example, the number of interaction terms that you could have if you allow up to all these second derivatives would be 50. So that is, of course, so basically here, writing down all possible interaction terms, quadratic terms, that are going to lead up to a maximum of 2 second derivatives of the perturbation fields in the equation. Yeah, so there you have dots and spatial, etc. So at the end, you're going to have about 50 free parameters. So of course, this is a number that is too big. You cannot actually manipulate this in any numerical calculation. And even analytically, it would be very difficult to work with 50 different terms. So that is one reason why imposing the gate symmetry is also very useful, because we would like to actually make further simplifications to this action. This is two-way general. And as you will see now, we're going to go to step 3, in which we're going to impose the action to be gate invariant, and that's going to reduce a lot this number of free parameters. And the way we impose gate invariance, is through the Nader identities. And as I said before, this is basically the main ingredient that is going to basically let us apply this method to actually any gauge symmetry, any set of fields, and it should be very straightforward. And this is also the reason why I think this writing down these quadratic actions with a given gauge symmetry hasn't been done before. Because what people usually do is that, for example, in the EF of dark energy formalizing, basically in step 2, they just write down directly all the terms that they know that are going to be gauge invariant. Because we're familiar with this specific diffeomorphism invariance, we know what the gauge invariant quantities are, so they just write directly all the terms that they know. They're going to be gauge invariant, and that's basically the action. That's your result. But that's very difficult to generalize. I mean, well, on one side, you might be losing some terms, and you don't have any way to check whether you're losing some terms. And it's very difficult to generalize to other kind of gauge symmetries that you could have, because you need to have this previous knowledge of your symmetry of constructing all these gauge invariant variables, which might be not easy. So the way we do it is that you don't need to have any previous knowledge. The only thing that you need to know is how the fields transform under this gauge symmetry, which is basically the definition of the gauge symmetry. So that's why this is very general. So what we are going to do is impose the total quadratic action to be gauge invariant. So that means it's going to be the quadratic action plus some other action that I could have, right? So these two things are going to be interacting. So the full action has to be gauge invariant. And that is gauge invariant. It basically means that if I make an infinitesimal transformation of my action due to this infinitesimal gauge transformation, so I'm going to write it like this, then this has to be zero, right? So the action is invariant. So you can actually calculate this variation, and that is how you get your Nether identities. There are going to be constraints that need to be satisfied in order to have a gauge invariant action. So, well, let's do it here.
You say you need some constant behind this gravity plus matter action.
Is there any?
I'm asking, are they coupled with Newton constant, or the gravity actually is different? It has no Newton constant.
So this gravity action, so the way I wrote it before, is going to have these arbitrary parameters that actually depend on time. So I will actually show later that the resulting action has this gravitational constant, or this general Planck mass, that is going to be a general function of time. So because here they're arbitrary, they could be anything. Okay.
when you say 50 free parameters,
if you allow for field redefinitions?
What do you mean by allow field redefinitions?
So you can redefine one of the fields by a function of time, for instance, and remove some of the parameters. So some of those parameters may be redundant because you can remove them by redefining these fields.
No, we didn't check that. So the only thing that we eliminated were terms that were boundary terms. So for example, delta n dot, we wouldn't add that because we would add delta n square and delta n dot square, stuff like that. So that's what we eliminated. But I don't know how the field redefinition would work if these free parameters are arbitrary. I think the field redefinition would work. I mean, you could have like some redundancy through field redefinitions if you knew specifically the form of your coefficients, like if you could absorb them somehow. But I don't know if
even a time-dependent coefficient could be reabsorbed by doing a time-dependent field redefinition.
Yeah. Ah, yeah. Yeah, that's true.
So you can probably reduce it by 2, I don't know.
Well, no, wait, you have it for each field. It should be a little,
yeah.
Only one scale over.
But there's not scale over.
Sorry? It should be a little with a one scale over. And that's it.
I would say, yeah, probably one parameter for each field you could probably reduce in this way.
Maybe.
This is only one field here, right? So this is 50 parameters.
49.
Yeah.
Well, there's several scalars in there. Like there's a bunch of, well, there's the, if you break up into transverse traces parts.
Are you talking about redefining the metric?
The perturbation fields.
Yeah.
Are you saying the perturbation fields?
Yeah, the perturbation fields.
Yeah. By time redefinitions.
Yeah.
No, I actually don't know. Well,
but what do you mean? I mean, you cannot redefine, because the metric is what like matter couples do, so what does it mean to redefine HIJ? Is that what you're talking about? Like,
yeah, that would be like changing frame, I guess.
Changing frame,
yeah.
Right. But then that's...
But unless you change the scalar. So at least in the specific case we're considering, for matter, at the end we decided to couple only the metric to matter. So you might... redefining your scalar in that case.
But at quadratic level, it's all decoupled anyway, so it isn't really notion of frame.
Yeah, okay, yeah, I have to think about that. I don't know if there will be any reduction actually at the end. So if you calculate the identities that you get from here, what you would get then is this, basically. So I'm going to write it this way. So if you make a general infinitesimal transformation, and as I said, we actually assume that this is going to be coupled only to the metric. So let me assume that this is going to be like a quintessence field.
What do you mean coupled to the metric at quadratic order? At quadratic order, as matter is just like a free...
So if this full action, if this was like the quintessence action,
yeah.
So at the full nonlinear level, would be coupled to the metric.
Yeah.
At the linear level, well, it means that there are going to be some quadratic terms like they're like delta phi coupled to the metric. And actually also this action would generate some terms that are quadratic in the metric, in the perturbations of the metric. So, okay, so if you consider that specific case, then let me write the variation of the action in this way. So you'd have something like this. Delta chi, and I'm gonna have also my matter field, which is this delta phi that I call. So here the delta is basically the name of the fields, delta n is one field, and the delta hat is this functional variation of the action. So if you made this variation of the action, you would get this, where basically all these E something are the equations of motion for those fields, right? So E, these E's are the equations of motion. And the idea is now, that if you replace, I mean, if this variation of fields, these delta hats, were due to the H transformation, then this should be zero, the variation of the action. So I'm going to write down explicitly what you would get if you did that, because I want to mention something about that. So you would get this, basically. So some terms, I mean, some fields are going to transform with derivatives of your gauge parameter epsilon mu. And you can make integration by parts to write the full variation of the action then in this way. And then something like this. Ni. So all the bars are the background values. H, L, J, epsilon I. Basically this. So as I said, I made some integration by parts. And the idea is that, well, now if the action is gauge invariant, then this has to be zero. And that means that each one of these square brackets must be zero because the gauge parameters are arbitrary. And these are what we call the nether identities. In general, basically they're constraints that your fields or your action is to satisfy. And in general, at the linear level, you're going to get one for each gauge parameter that you have. And as you can see here, this
net energy momentum conservation, right? For the deep invariant.
There would be, yeah, but it's not this. So the why? Usually the way in which we get the conserved quantities is through the boundary terms. And these terms that are not boundary terms are actually zero. Identically zero. So they are an entity, they're satisfied identically.
Okay. You're not talking about
But basically this is the same way of obtaining conserved quantities. But here we're not keeping boundary terms. Yeah, I'm finishing. Okay. So as you can see now, these nether identities are relations between your equations of motion, which are linear in the field because they come from this quadratic action. So these nether constraints are going to be linear in your field. So for example, for the time component, you would get something like that looks like this. Delta n dot plus etc. equals zero. So something that's linear in the fields and involving, in principle, all the fields. So now this has to be zero, and if this is zero, should be zero of shell, right? Because our action should be gauge invariant regardless of the specific solutions. So that means that each one of these coefficients needs to be zero. So, and these coefficients are background coefficients because this is linear. So at the end, and this is what we call the nether constraints. And they're just relations at the end between all these L coefficients. They're relations between all the background quantities. And you can solve all these constraints, replace back your solution into the quadratic action, and get your final action. So that's basically the procedure. So from here, you solve them and get your final quadratic gravity action with much less parameters. So in the specific example of scalar tensor theories up to two derivatives, you actually get at the end four free parameters. So now this number of parameters is much more manageable. Some people have actually made some comparisons to data with these parameters. And you can also assign, there is a lot of information that you can extract from here.
Like for this, it has more parameters than this, doesn't it?
Oh. Four. Okay. Yeah, so actually that is one comment that I wanted to mention. So about this specific sample. So actually what we get in this case is linearized Hondesky, which has four free parameters. And some people have found the specific relations between the four free parameters that appear in this linear cosmological action with the four here. And something else that, I don't know if it was obvious or not, but this action, this quadratic action, will actually propagate one scalar degree of freedom plus two tensor polarizations. And so the way I mentioned this because At the beginning, it wasn't obvious. So that actually follows from step three from imposing the H invariance. Because in step two, we actually wrote down all possible quadratic terms. And in principle, all the perturbations of the metric were actually propagating degrees of freedom. They were all dynamical. But after imposing the Gates symmetry, many of the fields are going to become auxiliary variables. They're not going to have any time derivatives. They're going to be, well, they're going to not going to be dynamical. And because of that, at the end, the action is going to propagate this number of degrees of freedom.
Did you impose that any of these fields be auxiliary?
No, so that followed from the Gates invariance, from the another constraints.
Okay, so why wouldn't you get things, for example, like suppose you have a higher derivative theory of gravity, like kappa bar theory or something like that, where it's, I guess you're going to say that has more than two derivatives. Mm-hmm.
So, right, so this is for this specific case with two derivatives, and then, as I said, we apply this case. Okay, so let me mention the cases that, all the cases in which we apply this. As a
tensor here,
with higher derivatives.
You wouldn't have seen it here because you limited it to two derivatives.
Right. Mm-hmm. But, okay, so just the final comments. So, I don't know, I mean, four, I think. And I'm going to mention some cases in which we applied this. So basically, this is a method for constructing these parameterized models. So we could assume different field content, different gauge symmetries, and we would have different parameterizations, different number of parameters at the end, different actions. So, but the important part is that it's general and systematic. And as I said, we don't need to have any previous knowledge on the gauge symmetries or nothing special. And we actually applied this to, as I said, scalar tensor up to three derivatives and also four derivatives, which are linearly diffeomorphic invariant. So in this case, you get five parameters. In this case, you get how many, like 11? Yeah.
So you have three derivatives, four special derivatives.
Yes. So here we also don't recover f of r because of this, that we allow a maximum of only two time derivatives, which won't happen. So actually, in all these cases that we worked out, we propagate the same number of degrees of freedom, one scalar and two tensor polarizations. And we also did it for vector tensor theories, up to two derivatives. That were diff invariants, and you get 10 free parameters. And on top of that, you could impose a U1 symmetry, in which, so diff and U1. And you get two free parameters. So the two free parameters is basically like a generalized Planck mass with a generalized factor in the Maxwell action. And another case, we applied it to vector tensor up to second derivatives with what we call an Einstein either constraint. So we're going to assume that we're going to have a vector tensor theory, and this vector has a preferred direction. So that's the either vector. And we know that we know some full nonlinear theories of this type, and they, in general, are not fully diff invariants. So they break the Lorentz invariants, actually. But at the linear level, they are linearly diffeomorphic invariants. So that you can use this formalism to encompass those kind of theories. And in this case, you get four free parameters. So I mentioned this because this is just at the linear level. We have no idea what's happening beyond that. So the nonlinear completions of these could be fully diff invariants or could not. And this is an example in which you could have theories that are not fully diff invariants. Diff invariant. The vector. So the vector is going to choose a preferred frame. So it's not diff invariant.
Well, I mean, it's...
Is that going to be fully diff?
Yeah.
Ah, yeah, but the solutions are going to be...
I mean, CMB has a preferred frame. I mean, any type of matter you have, in some sense, does, like air in this room gives you a preferred frame. That doesn't mean it breaks diff invariants.
Well, yeah, you can write it in an... So if you could write it in this different way, if you added like an extra Lagrange multiplier, if you solve that Lagrange multiplier, so that constraint, then your action wouldn't be a gauge invariant. Do we agree with that?
Solving Lagrange multiplier doesn't break the deficit.
Yeah.
No, because when you solve it, you have to solve this constraint, which basically says a, the vector a mu is going to be a specific solution. It's not going to be something arbitrary. So basically, you have to solve this. A mu equals minus one. That's the constraint that you have to solve when you solve it.
Right.
So what I'm saying is that in this action, even after you solve this constraint, it is still a linearly diff invariant. That's what I'm saying.
You haven't broken any gauge symmetry by solving that constraint. So it's true you have to pick a solution, but the result, when you plug that solution back in the action, doesn't that action still have diff invariance? It's just spontaneously broken.
So diff invariance, I would say it's not fully diff invariance if you have to replace the solution back into your action.
Well, I mean, usually you don't do that. Like, I mean, there are two. Writing
yeah.
the equation is one thing. You want that to be diff invariant, but
yeah.
then individual solutions are not diff invariant. So
yeah. Well, in this case, okay. So maybe I can rephrase it another way. In this specific case, the solutions at the linear level would still be diff invariant.
Hmm. Okay.
So not just the action. So the solutions.
Okay. I think we should wrap up. But
yeah.
So
yeah.
So
these are some examples and in. Right now, we're actually applying this to biometric theory to try to recover masses by gravity, stuff like that. And I just wanted to mention that, so the net identities are very useful here to impose any kind of gauge symmetry. And we have actually used the net identities before in cosmology as another application that you could have, which is basically for fixing a gauge in an action. So we usually work at the level of the equations of motion, and we pick any gauge to simplify our system when we're solving it. But if you wanted to fix the gauge in your action, you need to do it in a very specific way. You cannot set any gauge you want. And for knowing which gauge to choose, you can use the net identities also. So that's another application that you could have. Yeah, that's all I wanted to say.
Thank you. Getting a little bit late, so Macarena is going to be here today and tomorrow, and if you want to join us for dinner, I guess it's going to be pop night. So join. Any you want to say something?
Yeah,
can I ask what happens if you try to do just a tensor rather, instead of a scalar tensor?
Yeah, so we did only a tensor up to two derivatives,
uh-huh.
and you don't get GR. I mean, you get one free parameter, which is the Planck mass. So it's a free parameter function of time that is multiplying the entire action.
Okay.
And that's showing something very interesting, that at the linear level, since we're assuming the most general cosmological model that we could have, actually, we could be describing sick theories that nonlinear sick theories that at the linear level could be considered in this model. So we don't get exactly GR in this case. So we might get. We actually don't know what these other nonlinear theories could be.
So the another constraint doesn't put any constraint on the functional dependence of the Planck mass?
No, because. Okay, so something important is that we also, here we don't have any specific background solution. So the background is also kind of involved in a generic way.
Right, yeah.
So if you allow to have a general background evolution, you don't have any constraint in this extra parameter.
Yeah,
you don't get GR.
Because in general relativity, you can't linearize it around any background.
Right.
You linearize it around an Einstein space.
Yeah, yeah. So if you actually imposed your background to be exactly the Friedmann equation, then this m parameter would have to be a constant. So this m free parameter. But in general, we're keeping it general. We're assuming that we don't know what the background equations are, and therefore this m parameter, this free parameter, is free.
Okay, so you get gauge invariant actions for a single tensor that can live on any background,
yes.
as long as the Planck mass has, with an arbitrary time dependence.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
At the quadratic level.
Yeah, the quadratic level. Yeah.
But I guess I'm just saying that that's That's how Vasputan would look like, I imagine.
But that has no, does that have a, oh yeah, there's no dynamic scaling.
Right, right. So you can, you could, at the linear as ever, you know, Kasputan is just if you have a field with infinite the speed of sound, just like a quiescence field with infinite the speed of sound, then you could actually solve algebraically, at the linear level, you could just solve for the field and plug back into the action. The scalar doesn't have any dynamics.
Yeah, you could have that.
So it's kind of allow for an arbitrary scale factor.
Yeah, right. So you have like you have an arbitrary potential that can give you an arbitrary.
Right.
There's a cache though. I think you need something else there. Not the I'm not sure. You cannot just have Pascutan.
No, you
cannot. Yeah, that's maybe that's useful, but yeah, you cannot. Maybe.
So this field is gonna be like it's gonna be multiplying directly the curvature of the tensor. How is it going to appear? So how is it going to be interacting with the metric?
It's just a minimal interaction.
But you said that it doesn't have dynamics?
Because it's infinite, as infinite as speed of sound, so equations can be solved algebraically, and at least in Fourier space. We can talk about this more, yeah. But
yeah.
Let these guys go. There are too many of them left.
Yeah.
So,
okay.
Okay, thank you. And yeah, my camera is going to be here. Okay, thanks.